Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
Someone in Victoria, it's South Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Tasmania. We don't have that assurity of we're not going to get that knock on the door by a local government representative, and we have to fight through the magistrate court to have a place to live.
If you want to live in an affordable tiny home, it apparently doesn't matter whether you have checked all the state government legislation, as local councils can still, in some cases, evict you in a diabolical morass of rules and regulations between state and local governments. We find out what happened to a couple in Bega, New South Wales. So stay tuned to The Wire Weekly. But first... The launch of the Special Envoy Report into Anti-Semitism paints a disturbing picture of intolerance that has risen in Australia following the eruption of violence since the October 7 attacks. Stephen Hill asked Dr. Mike Kelly from Labor Friends of Israel how concerning the situation was in Australia when it comes to the presence of the world's oldest prejudice.
Well, it should be concerning to everyone, and I know that it is the majority of Australians. I think that was a problem for the government last year, that they weren't realising there was a big groundswell of concern about just domestic security. Because if you talk to people in the Hindu or Sikh or Buddhist or a Thai Filipino, Pacific Islander, they know that if a synagogue burns today, it's going to be a temple or a church that burns tomorrow. There was a real worry that it wasn't being properly addressed. And I think the original sin there was that horrific moment on the 9th of October 2023, when that illegal demonstration chanting, "Where's the Jews?" and "F the Jews," etc., threatening violence, denied the Sydney Jewish community the ability to just mourn the horror and the tragedy of the savagery that was committed on the 7th of October. So when that wasn't dealt with properly, the law enforced a place made safe for that community, it sort of fed the steady escalations we saw, the vandalism, the arson.
In the report, what the Special Envoy describes as online platforms that have become vectors for conspiracy theories and hate speech, do you think more has to be done to combat the rise of intolerance that's appearing in various guises online?
Stephen, you have hit on the main point here, and it's a major focus for me. I'm an adjunct professor out at the National Security Institute at the University of Canberra, where we have been focusing on the general information warfare challenge that the West faces right now. Democracy has been under siege, it's been corroded, it's been defeated. And particularly since 2016, when Russia showed what it could achieve in getting Donald Trump elected. Then Iran and China, you know, North Korea learning those lessons, and now them coordinating amongst themselves. And I don't think a lot of people realise just how coordinated, insidious and volumised that is through the assets and the abilities of the states. That is now fueling the neo-Nazis on the right and then the most extremists and the Marxists in the middle and left. You know, it's just all over the spectrum of the threats that we face, and it's why the Australian went over to New Zealand and shot up 50 Muslims in New Zealand, that appalling incident. So it threatens all of us because they don't care who they're targeting as long as there's social disruption.
So what I discovered is also that you yourself, when you were an elected representative, have been targeted by white nationalists with a neo-Nazi sticker from a group labelled the Antipodean Resistance. What was that experience like for yourself and your staff?
For my staff, it was deeply traumatising. And so to come to work in the morning and have one of those really confronting and offensive posters on your window of your office, you know, which you suspect that would ever happen in a place like Bega. But they did come down, and they also did homophobic attacks after the plebiscite happened to a... We had a gay couple running the post office in Cobargo. But the community rallied and washed that stuff off their walls. They came down and put up anti-migration stuff, and then in my electorate office in Queanbeyan left pigs' entrails or something in front of the door. And now we've seen these days a lot of my former colleagues and MPs getting the same treatment, but even worse now, like Peter Carlisle, for example, his electorate office, they drilled a hole in the wall and and introduced toxic materials into his office, which was highly hazardous. And so they had to get in a hazmat team. They started a fire in front of Josh Burns' electorate office in a building that had apartments.
Okay, so one of the recommendations that is receiving a lot of media attention due to potential of it being abused is the potential for the government to withdraw funding from universities, public broadcasters and cultural organisations. Is there a danger that we could end up in a situation where we've got, like in the US, where Donald Trump has withdrew $400 million from Columbia University?
Yeah, look, that needs to be handled very carefully. And you want to approach this by actually building a bit of a consensus around what's going on. Your media resources are looking for a simple black hat, white hat paradigm to squeeze things into. The simplification and the then typecasting who the players are. And I don't think there's a complete answer to that right now, but we do have to appreciate that our university landscape is problematic. There was terrible stuff going on our campuses. In some ways, this can be addressed by simply pulling together and determining what is acceptable and what isn't on a university campus, and opening universities to be what they ought to be, places of enlightenment, of debate, of reason, where you can have discussions without being shouted down, intimidated or targeted, cancelled, boycotted, etc.
Dr. Mike Kelly, former Labor member for Eden Monaro and adjunct professor in the National Security Institute at the University of Canberra, speaking with Stephen Hill. Tiny house residents are facing fines of $10,000 daily, remaining in a public battle against council after receiving a letter saying their tiny home on wheels in the Bega Valley isn't compliant. Recently, their online petition, backed by 27,000 signatures, was rejected on a technicality. Emma Watsky asked tiny homeowner Joshua Hines how they came to purchase a tiny home.
We've got 12 square metres in the whole world, and that was reasonable for us. It was an opportunity for us to work towards a bigger goal of maybe one day having our own place. Our tiny home is parked on a rural property. There's an occupied dwelling house. It's owned by an older retired couple, and they've got lots of veggie gardens and some sheep and an orchard. And so we spend plenty of time on the property helping them, and it's just supported us to feel comfortable and secure in the area.
In April, that sense of security changed when the couple and the landowner received a draft order from council stating the tiny home needs to be removed or demolished to align with New South Wales environmental planning legislation, with a potential court-imposed fine of up to $1 million. Mr. Bone took to his change.org petition, writing, "If you live in the Bega Valley, you'll have seen homelessness, limited rental stock, soaring rents and property sale prices. The couple didn't seek council permission or development approval, but say they didn't believe it was required and built based on state legislation."
The compliance staff came back to the property. They had an opportunity to see that our home was on a trailer, measure it up and understand that it's within the dimensions and weight limits of a registerable caravan. But they did issue a final order because they've determined that the structure isn't a caravan and they think it is a structure under what we have in New South Wales, which is the Environmental Protection and Assessment Act. We consider it to be a caravan, and that's a real point of contention.
In a statement to The Wire, Bega Valley Shire Council said they are not able to discuss the details of individual cases, but acknowledge strong community interest in tiny homes and movable dwellings, and need for state legislation that supports flexible housing options. Tiny homes are not defined under the New South Wales planning framework. While in some instances a caravan may be exempt, in other instances will require a DA for land use approval. Meanwhile, New South Wales Planning Minister Paul Scully told Wind News last month, when it comes to movable vehicles, ultimately it comes down to matters between the Local Government Act and Council's action and compliance. Years from local bushfires, Mr. Hines says clarity between local and state government on tiny homes is long overdue. In the meantime, their petition calls Council to suspend tiny home evictions.
"I'm pretty disappointed. We're here 5 years after the bushfire and 2 or 3 years since our local council's declared a housing crisis, and we're still arguing about this solution."
But owners and industry say confusion and red tape around planning rules and approval processes present barriers. While experts suggest tiny homes can be subject to regulatory grey areas with inconsistencies in state laws, tiny house classification, and some councils struggling to implement these in their policies. Volunteer National President for the Australian Tiny House Association, Rochelle Ryan, echoes these views. She also points to land use and occupancy length, which create additional complexities rates, particularly in a housing crisis.
In a housing crisis where you're desperate for a place to live and you can afford to either build or purchase a tiny home, you can casually live in a structure like a shed for 2 years without an issue. But if you stay beyond that second anniversary, you then go into a very unknown area.
More needs to be done at a national level to ensure consistency around tiny homes across each state as people struggle to afford housing.
Someone in Victoria, it's South Australia, Queensland, New South Wales, Tasmania, we don't have that surety of we're not going to get that knock on the door by a local government representative, and we have to fight through the magistrate court to have a place to live.
Emeritus Professor of Planning and Urban Management at Griffith University, Paul Burton, says while tiny home living is not the single answer to the housing crisis, it could be a viable option.
Tiny homes can make a valuable contribution. They can add to the choice and the diversity of housing available. Tiny homes come in all shapes and sizes. And the most important distinction is between those that are fixed on the ground and those that are on wheels.
Burton highlights council concerns and says standards for tiny homes are vital, from environmental and building safety through to financial compliance. Meanwhile, pilot programs in Shell Harbour City Council New South Wales and Surf Coast Shire Victoria are trialling tiny home living without required development applications. Burton says programs like these could offer a pathway provided policies are adapted with changing times.
In those trials, and we will specify the areas and the zones that exist already, if you're proposing a tiny home there and you can meet these criteria, you're kind of deemed almost to have approval. It won't have to go through a lengthy and costly planning assessment process. I think those are really good initiatives by those councils.
Back in the Bega Valley, Mr. Hines says they will continue to work to understand council's determination.
Emma Watsky ending that report. US President Donald Trump has been losing patience with the response Vladimir Putin has been providing to his overtures to end the war on Ukraine. He has shortened his time for a suitable response from Russia and has moved to include 50% tariffs on Indian imports unless they stop buying Russian oil. I asked UTS industry professor and chief economist Tim Harcourt whether it would be just India and China that will be targeted by the US.
India, China, Turkey, the EU, but principally, yes, China and India. And that, of course, causes some complications in a sense because, Trump has been trying to move trade away from China towards India. But, of course, India has a huge trade with Russia in terms of oil.
And they've also got other relationships too, going back years on defence and so forth, haven't they?
Yeah, well, Indira Gandhi with the non-aligned movement was pretty close to the Soviet Union, and probably less so today, but they are one of the BRICS economies, and that seems to be a block in a way. I'd say it's more frenemies. I don't think there's any love between them. It's more partnership of convenience.
The objective is, of course, to weaken the Russian economy to try and get Putin to pull back from the war in Ukraine. How effective do you think this might be?
Well, hasn't been so far. Probably because Russia's been able to get past the sanctions through its partnership with China and India and Iran too, you've got to say, although they've now been weakened. So they've got to try something. And, defence spending in Russia is 6% of GDP. They are really cranking up to Soviet Union levels of defence spending.
And is this going to make then world oil prices go up, do you think?
Oh, most likely. There'll be more disruption to the global economy at a time when India was going quite well with the United States, but their recent disputes over trade has made it very difficult, and this will just add to that.
Is Vladimir Zelensky, do you think, in favour of this approach, or would he rather get, armaments and things?
Oh, I think anything to weaken Russia, he'd be in favour. He's still battling to hold them at bay. The only good thing is that, in some ways, the pressure that Trump's put on the European Union has helped, Ukraine a bit, because they've started to pull a bit more weight now instead of having to rely just on the Americans for support. So there's a bit more from Europe and the UK that wasn't happening before.
Which countries in the European Union are getting the Russian oil? I mean, I don't...
Not Germany, I mean...
They don't have any bans on receiving Russian oil, but they do on gas, do they?
Well, they're a little bit cagey about it, the EU, and they've been in Australia looking at green hydrogen and all sorts of things to replace it, but I think oil, gas, nuclear is still part of the German energy future for the time being.
What sort of effects are we going to see on the world economy when we're going to have higher energy prices then having knock-on effects?
Oh, probably, but... on the other hand, if it does weaken Russia, then that could, you know, improve situations in the global economy if it brings the war to an end. But again, I mean, you can let Russia take Ukraine if you like, but that could be more catastrophic for the world than higher oil prices in the short term.
I suppose the big problem will be China, because US has just recently managed to change and sort of smooth over the relationship with trade with China. So if they're going to put a 100% tariff on China because of the Russian oil, that's going to open up the wound again, isn't it?
Oh, I don't think the wound's ever closed. I mean, it's clearly competitive tension. It might persuade the Chinese to tell Putin to back down. But, you know, they can tell him to do that. Doesn't mean he will.
The Russians have been making some pretty serious strikes on the Ukrainian soil in the last couple of weeks. Does that kind of indicate that Putin's really not that worried about whatever Trump's going to do?
Well, at the moment he's not, but I think, you know, given that a third of his exports are oil and gas, if the sanctions did work, then he would have something to worry about. Even a dictatorship does worry about public opinion to some extent.
US industry professor and chief economist Tim Harcourt speaking with me there. One of the nation's few copper smelting facilities is at risk of closure as global processing costs drop. Mount Isa in Queensland's northwest is situated on top of the deepest copper mine in the country, which ceased operations just last week. But now the town is facing an existential threat as mining giant Glencore could shut down the smelting facilities if there isn't further government support. Noah Seckham asked Mount Isa City Council Mayor Peter McRae how important copper smelting was to Australia.
Well, it was announced about 18 months ago that the underground copper mine in Mount Isa was closing. That's a mine that's been there for about 100 years, a multi-generational mine that is built right pretty much smack in the centre of our town. So it's part of our history and it's part of our heritage and it's why Mount Isa exists primarily. As a newly elected mayor and as a council, we heavily invested in a transition and diversification strategy to develop new industry in our area. And that was going, you know, quite well. There were some green shoots and we'd come up with some exciting projects. However, on the last week of the mines, we finally got to D-Day and Glencore announced that they were considering putting the smelter into care and maintenance and sent a letter to staff to prepare to go into care and maintenance. Now, what that means is the smelter in Mount Isa feeds the refinery over in Townsville. So if the smelter closed in Mount Isa, that would also mean that the refinery in Townsville would close. When you smelt, there's a byproduct that comes off that sulfuric acid. So there is a national sulfuric acid shortage, and that is actually used to process the phosphate that comes out of another mine there, Phosphate Hill. What they use that phosphate for is it makes a fertilizer. That fertilizer is then used for the whole sugarcane industry. Most of Queensland, it's what they use. Now, the fertilizer plant, that is the largest user of our rail line. And the model of the rail line is cost recovery. So it is the only rail line in Queensland that has to wash its own face, so to speak, pay for its own existence. If our economic ecosystem was a body, then the smelter is our heart. So without the heart, it just does not survive.
So it was the closure of the mine at the start, which is what you were preparing for. And
yep,
the smelter
this
has
week,
come out of nowhere.
When Glencore announced the underground copper mine closure, they said that the smelter was confirmed to continue until 2030 and they were paying for the next rebrick. We thought that was under control until at least 2030. However, what's happened since then is an election in the United States. So what we see happening is everyone's moving away from a free market into their protectionist policies. The United States are paying their smelters to smelt so they have that sovereign capability to compete against China. China is paying for their smelters to smelt because they want to dominate critical minerals, copper and metal production into the future. So if we don't help our smelters to remain viable during this period of time, we won't maintain that sovereign capability of smelting. Too often in this country, we see it where we just rip and chip our natural resources. We dig them out of the ground, we ship them overseas to others to create and add value, and then we buy them back at extreme prices. So we have this huge project called Copper String that's going to be linking Mount Isa in the west to Townsville in the east, because at the moment, we're not connected to the national electricity grid. We're a power island out there and we're powered by gas. It's called the Copper String Project. Where is the copper coming from if we don't have the smelter? It is just so vital to our future. So that's why I'm down here. And it's really heartening. We know the ministers and the senators understand. We've got three levels of government working together. We've got industry on board. I think everyone sees what an important issue this is, but now it's time to get some action.
What are your concerns moving forward for the future of your area and Queensland and the country?
It's just making, I think, decarbonisation that much more difficult. Everyone wants to, you know, do the right thing. Copper's going to be essential. And I think the whole gas situation is just an indication of what could happen to copper. Like, we're shipping it off overseas and then buying it back. I don't even understand why we're not using it ourselves. I guess it is what happens when big companies dictate what happens. And sometimes we're just going to need to reserve some of our resources for our own national needs and national capability. We've also got like an exciting project called Green Gravity out of the University of Wollongong, where they're looking at dropping weights down X mine shafts to create energy that is completely green and then store it in a battery. So that's a really exciting project too, that, you know, it's got 300 or 400 jobs in that for our community. So when Copper String comes along, these green energy projects are going to be able to plug into that. So when it's dark down south, it's still daylight where we are, and we're actually going to be powering most of the state with completely green energy. We've got a, you know, a bright future and an important role to play in terms of decarbonisation. I think that's an interesting thing as well.
Mount Isa City Council Mayor Peter McRae there with NRN reporter Noah Seckham. The Australian Defence Force has seen the biggest increase in recruitment in over 15 years, following a sustained pattern of decline. 24-25, the ADF enlisted more than 7,000 new personnel, the highest annual intake since 2010. This represents a 17% increase over last year. Maeve Groom asked Professor Robert Hoffman from the Tasmanian Behavioural Lab at the University of Tasmania what he thinks is driving this surge in recruitment.
Yeah, the first thing we should say is that this came as a considerable shock to most of us after we faced a period of severe shortages. So suddenly we get this really great news. The problem in identifying the drivers is that several things have changed at the same time. So it's a little bit difficult to tell exactly what it was.
And in terms of this advertising and promoting services, it's been attributed to targeted advertising on platforms such as TikTok and online gaming. Do you think this is the best way to appeal to Gen Z in particular of what a career in the Defence Force entails?
Yes, it makes sense. And it does tally with what professionals have been discussing in this space. Gen Z people are digital natives. TikTok, I'm probably a little bit too old to talk about this, but things like TikTok appear to be where they are. And to embed the messages in those media that these people are used to is probably the right way to go.
So why was recruitment initially lagging for such a long time? And what made Australians reluctant to consider enlisting in the ADF?
I mean, I think the reason why recruitment has been a problem in most Western volunteer forces, and the reason could be potentially changing values of the population. I think as generations change, values like patriotism, nationalism, duty and service have probably changed. What we do know with Generation Z specifically is that they are very interested in personal motivations, making a difference, looking for meaning. And these things do not always obviously tally with service in the defense forces. And the other reason, of course, is to some people, service in defense forces might be associated with mental and physical hardship, with fighting. And of course, in the modern army, that's no longer necessarily the case. There's a lot of humanitarian missions, peacekeeping and similar things. And I think once they're properly advertised, service will become much more attractive.
What has the ADF done in particular to market the Defence Force as a career prospect for young people?
They're just basically trying to appeal in the advertising to the kind of non-combat things you might get out of a military career. For instance, one example would be you get trained in using modern technologies, the camaraderie and comradeship, but also, of course, making a positive difference. If you are on a humanitarian mission abroad, you are making a positive difference, and that appeals. And I think those aspects of service have been highlighted correctly, to my mind.
Do you believe some Australians may be primarily driven to enlist based on their own political views on the current climate of the world and the various conflicts going on?
Yeah, we do know from other countries and from Australia that service is associated with certain kinds of views and demographics, certain political views, certain views of country and so on and so forth. But that's probably not the driver here for the uptick that we've seen in Australia, because those views don't change overnight. And the uptick is from one year to the next. So they will probably have an impact slowly and over the years, but it's certainly not enough to explain what we've seen in the news in the last few days.
Do you believe this surge could represent a renewed nationalist or patriotic movement within Australia, akin to what we see in countries like the US?
I know that in the US, some commentators have basically argued that increased patriotism is behind the increased numbers that they are seeing. My experience is slightly different. As I'm speaking as a European here and born in Germany, although I'm Australian, the war in Ukraine is very, very personal for many Europeans, especially in Central Europe. And we have seen a similar uptake in the German armed forces. But interviews have revealed that the Ukraine war, no matter how personal it is to people, was not the main driver behind it.
Is there anything that the ADF could do to keep this surge in recruitment, to encourage people to continue to enlist?
I think what I would have to say as a scientist is they've done so many things at the same time, all good things, that it's very, very hard to tell which did the work here. And we would need much more analysis, much more research to find out. That kind of research, of course, is advertising research. So as an economist, I wouldn't like to comment too much on that.
Professor Robert Hoffman from the Tasmanian Behavioural Lab at the University of Tasmania, speaking there with Maeve Groom. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week. But we're going to be back again next week. And of course, The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.